listening to a Radio Geekly. Good morning, everyone in the Rose City. Welcome to another exciting episode of a Radio Geekly. I am just Jess, and I'm joined in the studio by some of our collective members. I've got Kyle, Becky, and SW Concert, aka Conch. Welcome, everyone.
Hello, all.
I'm doing good.
Yay.
I was reading an Archie comic on the way here. I'm very excited.
Appropriate for our discussion.
Published
today.
In 1974.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Dang.
Back in the Dan DiCarlo days.
Yeah. So today's discussion is going to be on comics. And since there is such a wide array of comics in the graphic arts genre, we are going to extend it into 2 months of episodes.
Yes. Be prepared.
So thanks, everybody, for joining us. I am feeling much more refreshed after having a month traveling the world. Thanks to all of you for contributing for last month's episode.
Oh, yeah, of course.
It was quite awesome to hear about LARPing.
Oh, yeah.
I'm like this much closer now to actually participating in my first ever LARP. So,
and that is our purpose, our mission statement. Convince people to get real nerdy.
I like your armor, by the way. That's a fabulous battle outfit you brought in today.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm trying to see how much I can actually weigh on my body, to do the appropriate actions and stuff.
That's cool. I'm ready with my spell packets,
Okay.
It's on when you go outside. Watch out.
And it's beautiful outside, so there's more opportunity to LARP. But today we are going to discuss comics.
Yes.
And myself, and I know a few of us listeners out there are not super savvy on comics, so we brought a few of our collective members that do have a love and appreciation for comic books. So I was just curious, Kyle and Conch, how did you guys get into the comic book genre, or what made you want to explore the genre even more?
For me, I would describe it in three phases.
Okay.
The first phase was just when I was a kid, I would just read, whatever comics that came around, like funnies in the newspaper, or like I subscribed to Nickelodeon magazine. I read a lot of their stuff. The second phase was just getting as many Simpsons comics that I could read.
Oh.
And I think the third phase, which kind of I think was also instrumental, was getting into a lot of 80s and 90s Vertigo comics. Like a lot of comics writers that came from 2000 AD were working for DC and Vertigo, and they kind of helped the comic scene in that way. And also, since then, I've been getting into just expanding as to learn as much about comics history as I could, getting in a small press, and just a lot of the more genres, the better, I think. Mm-hmm. That gives you a good understanding of what the medium can offer.
Nice. Conch?
Well, I can't remember a time when I wasn't making comics. My folks have these comics I was making when I was 3 years old.
Whoa.
Mm-hmm. Like these Pooh and Eeyore comics that I was big into animation too, which is what I eventually moved into. But moving to Portland, this is the black hole of comics artists. I'm kind of sad that we no longer have the late lamented Stumptown Comics Fest. There's a movie playing today, and we're going to be talking about that a little bit more, 24-hour comic, which shows the Stumptown Comics Fest that would bring several people from around the country and around the world, and you'd inevitably have a couple of them move to Portland after the Comic-Con and where they have remained. And I just love the collective atmosphere of this town, where you have all of these great little collectives of folks like they keep changing the name. It was Periscope, now it's Helioscope. Mm-hmm. Originally Mercury Studios, but they have so many incredible people, including Paul Guinan, Anana Bennett, Mike Russell's in there, I think Colleen Coover, Erica Moen, just these and they get so much cool insight off each other, and they pose for each other. It's fun to get with a group of people who will say, hey, I need a pose. And instead of bothering to look up a reference online, somebody will just strike a heroic pose. All right, hold that. And then they'll draw
that. Yeah, that's the way to do it.
Yeah, I like the appreciation of the community for the comic scene, because it's it is more inclusive than a lot of us think about. And with the intro that we heard from Merrick Monroe, she's actually the manager at Bridge City Comics. And she was talking about how she walks into her shop and there's such a diverse group of customers that are around actually looking for rare, you know, archival kind of comic books, not just what's the latest and greatest. And so I think that's really cool how we've expanded not only through like the genre itself, but through like generations and through time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we have a great infrastructure for folks that are looking to, you know, do their own comics, like create them, draw, write, that sort of thing, in a way that I don't think that many cities do. Like having the IPRC is like a resource, is a humongous boon to everybody, I think, and is a place, a repository for also the DIY aspect of that and self-publishing.
This reminds me, the Independent Publishing Resource Center, which has been around for like just about as long as I've been in town, like since the 90s, mm-hmm. has found a new home. They were originally downtown near Powell's, then they moved to Southeast. Now they're going to be in the historic Gardeners and Ranchers building at 1305 Southeast Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard. So this is great if you are a kid, if you are an oldster like us, if you are anybody who wants to try like crazy old stuff like letterpress.
Oh yeah,
and all of these old techniques. You know, I just keep hearing. I was at the premiere last night of 24 Hour Comic, and I missed. By the way, one of the things I missed is first Thursday at places like Floating World and Sequential Art mm-hmm. Gallery in the Pearl. These are places where comic art, and you can meet all kinds of great comics artists, but every month, and last night was a big one with folks like Farrell Dalrymple, who's a friend of Kabu, who's come in several times, did Pop Gun War, which is out now, the second volume. But if you want to be part of that community yourself, the IPRC, the Independent Publishing Resource Center, is going to be, they're closed right now, they're ramping up again, but man, they have a zine library that mm-hmm. Thousands of people have contributed to, so that just that library is so inspiring.
Oh, absolutely, and seeing early works from folks that have moved on and have done, you know, amazing things, folks that are relatively anonymous. It's really incredible the sort of resources that are available there.
I've seen some of Becky's zines.
Mm-hmm. No. You're a good artist there.
I've loved drawing myself for a long time. My parents had old comics that I had created when I was a youngster too, and
good art is the best.
I know. I remember so clearly, like my parents having this humongous piece of furniture that had all these stamps, and me creating art around it in comic book form. And then, you know, as my professional art career had, you know, advanced, I moved on to photography. But I still have a very deep love of creating zines, and I hope to do more of it, but my time has been so filled with stuff, so I don't know.
Well, people need to stay tuned in, because we're going to be talking about the Portland Zine Symposium, which is mm-hmm. another awesome thing later. And I still have copies of Fact Sheet 5. That's as nerdy as you can get. Like still having old Fact Sheet 5 magazines that just collect all of this information about old zines.
So mm-hmm. what is, this might sound like a silly question, but what would be the difference between a zine versus like a graphic novel?
Well, you know, I mean, a graphic novel, that tends to be something that's, and people will self-publish graphic novels now. Yeah. That's more and more of a thing, especially with web comics. You'll see a lot of collected web comics. Folks like Dylan McConis, who mm-hmm. does Family Man, has collected those. Let's see, there's Jen Manley like Lee has done some amazing stuff.
The oatmeal folks, yeah.
But traditionally, it's going to be something that's really gone to a lot of effort and found a publisher, and it's kind of slick. And a zine, really, I mean, it's just photocopied. Tends to be on demand.
Sometimes
although again,
stapled, but not necessarily.
Yeah, although again, the lines are kind of starting to get wiggly, because you do have on demand publishing for more slick stuff. Mm-hmm. But yeah, graphic novel tends to be, you know, more of like one huge concept, and a zine can kind of be a mishmash. You can also have, you know, not just comics in there, but poetry, okay. But you know, Comet Bus. Aaron Lowell was one of the great guys who was. It was all about his travels all around the country and around the world. So it can be. It really is like much more of a personal project for the most part.
Yeah, zines sometimes don't have a graphic like quality. Sometimes it could just be information being transferred. You know, like Know Your Rights trainings and things like that are often in zine form, speaking to the accessibility of how to publish in that way and then how to spread it, the information that you're looking to spread as easily and quickly as possible. I mean, I remember like going to info shops in different cities and seeing similar zines in different places because people knew to send their stuff there. Hmm. Or if you were part of a collective or just like join a mailing list, then people would send their zines to you. Well, so
I think there's a lot of historical significance in zines also in spreading information, especially like with passing pamphlets during like a political turmoil of some sort, especially with the roots of American journalism with Common Sense and things like that.
Another thing that has fallen a little by the wayside in the digital age, but years ago, and I'll give a shout out to Pals. Pals has a small press section. The late lamented Reading Frenzy, which was Chloe Udaly's place, some zines had little little CDs in them, and so I'd get one with music people had recorded in North Africa and things like that. So it was really a way before everything was streaming, everything was available on the web to disseminate stuff that was really underground, under the popular culture radar.
And now I think we've kind of moved into more of a digital age where now a lot of these comics are being posted online and websites are being more prevalent. And so one of those mediums that I feel like comics are going into is more of like the social media web presence platform, because it can be posted at any time and can be accessed virtually anywhere where there's the internet, you know, some sort of connectivity. And I know, Kyle, you actually spoke with somebody that is working within the web scene for comics.
Yes, indeed I did.
Who did you speak to?
I interviewed Megan Purdy, who's the founder and editor of Women Write About Comics.
Okay.
And in the recording, it's minuscule, but I kept calling it Women Writes About Comics, which is also getting the name wrong and getting it wrong grammatically. That's just worth noting. But all of their contributors are either women or people who identify as non-binary, and they were recently nominated for an Eisner for their comics journalism.
Oh, wow. So let's take a listen to Kyle's interview with Megan Purdy, and we'll be back to talk more comics.
How did Women Writes About Comics get started?
As a blog carnival, which is where you ask a bunch of bloggers from different sites to write on a certain topic, and they all come together and post it on the same day. And I started the blog carnival because I was mad at the Comics Journal, which was, you know, sort of a long-time serious publication of note about comics. And it also happens to be really white and male-dominated. And they wrote another one of these many articles, which happen in every industry, but I work in comics, so it was particularly annoying to me. It was one of those, where are all the women? And this was, you know, where are all the women in comics? And I thought, well, obviously we're right here writing about comics, reading comics, making comics, editing and publishing comics. So I started the blog carnival, and it really took off. And I realized that people in my immediate network really wanted to have a place to share their thoughts on comics that they felt safer within rather than a lot of the big sites. So Claire and I turned it into a site, and it grew and grew and grew. And now it's a medium-sized site that it is today.
Okay, so when you set out to represent marginalized communities, when did you feel that is exactly what we wanted to accomplish with the site? So I'm wondering when, if there was a set of moments that made you realize that, like, this is a good thing to do.
Well, part of our ethos at Women Write About Comics, it's an all-volunteer site. And from the beginning, one of the parts of our ethos has always been that we, too, would be learning on the job. And we would be, as we would learn, we would mentor younger writers. So I wouldn't say there was like particular points at which we knew exactly what we wanted to do, because not knowing the exact perfect direction that we wanted to go in was actually something that we really embraced, because we want to experiment and try things, and constantly be evolving and meeting new people. But I would say like after about a year, we really started to realize that it was going to be a much bigger project than what we initially thought. So when I moved, obviously, as I said earlier, we started as a blog carnival. And when we first created the site, it was mainly interviews of women working in comics. Mm-hmm. And as we started bringing in a couple more bloggers who wanted to contribute, because they're really interested in the product, in the project as well, we started publishing reviews, essays, opinion pieces, all kinds of things. And after about a year, we started realizing that it was going to be basically, you know, like a digital magazine rather than the much lighter site that we had set out to create.
This may be more of a broad question. Since the election, I guess, like, political conversations have infiltrated a lot of facets of pop culture and arts mm-hmm. medium. Not to say that those conversations didn't exist before, far before, but it just seems more people are on high alert now. So I'm wondering if you noticed a distinct shift in the comics medium.
Absolutely. Just looking at, say, the conversation on social media among people in the comics sphere, you see a lot of people have dropped off talking about new comics or their craft or projects that they have upcoming. And instead, we've seen like a huge shift to people just devoting so much of their time and their lives to political activism. And we're starting to see more comics that have, I guess, an overtly political topical message. So things dealing with Trump and different kinds of reactions. Like there's been a few recent comics, you know, obviously there's anti-Trump comics. I wouldn't say there's exactly pro, but there's been a couple of dubious, confused. Are you aware of the Nazi Captain America controversy?
I haven't read the material, but I'm aware of some of the controversy, yeah.
So I would sort of classify that in a pro-fascist vein, but I'm not sure that the writer entirely knows that he's writing something that's pro-fascist. You know, he's sort of a confused former progressive or something. It's not entirely clear what he's trying to achieve with this product, with this project. And then more recently at Image, Howard Chaykin published a comic called Divided States of Hysteria, which is very much commenting on the current political climate. And he says that it is, you know, attempt to comment negatively on the effect that Trump has had on the American community. But what he's instead ended up doing is recreating a lot of visual depictions of pain and torture of people of color, trans women. It's turned out to be one of those edgy to be edgy kind of comics. Mm-hmm. So far, I would say the comics response to politics has been strong, but not, you know, in any one particular direction, which I suppose is very reflective of America itself.
How do you think the historical significance of comics as resistance plays on to the recent shift or the recent high alert in the medium? Like, I'm thinking specifically, like, say, after the election results were announced, two anthologies started to like get off the ground. The Resist comic was accepting submissions, as well as Comics for Choice, which is the pro-choice anthology. So I'm wondering what how the historical history of comics plays into that.
I think comics is an amazing medium for, you know, like resistant artistic works. It does have a, you know, relatively low cost to create, publish and distribute, particularly self-published comics and, you know, zines have been huge historically in terms of disseminating, you know, like alternative political messages, material that represents marginalized minorities. And if you look at however, the history of American comics is kind of complicated. You know about the Comics Code Authority and the whole sort of shrinking of American comics as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
In the wake of the Comics Code Authority, which was kind of a McCarthy era censorship apparatus that was voluntarily adopted by the comics business so that they would not have something worse imposed upon them by the government. The comics business as a whole shrank drastically. And in the decades following, it became extremely reliant on like very dedicated fans and like the hobby market. So specialty shops, comics only or comics and toys, those kinds of things. The scope of what could be published in comics or what was imagined to be part of comics shrank drastically and became focused so much on superhero comics. In terms of like mainstream comics, truly political work or either resistant or affirming wasn't really being published commonly in by the large companies, either by Marvel, DC, or even through book publishers. However, starting in the 60s, there was like alt comics and underground comics really started to get going. Usually you hear about characters like Robert Crumb and similar guys out on the West Coast. However, there was also a lot of people of color also creating their own comics, which are not commonly seem to be part of this scene. So I think there's like quite a few decades of small press and indie publishing comic scene established doing really radical political work. And I think that only in the last few decades has that really come back into the larger publishers. Mm-hmm. And I think actually the internet has played a huge role in the comics community being able to do large political projects again, because, you know, even today, obviously publishers are a little bit shy about publishing something really radical or resistant or controversial, right? Like for obvious business reasons. On the other hand, thanks to the internet and particularly Kickstarter, a group of people can come together and raise, you know, like $100,000 to create a really cool political anthology. Or somebody like the Resist team, who actually they've been in comics for a really, really long time, were able to leverage their clout to pull something together like that so quickly in time for the Women's March. I think things are changing a lot. Yes, or I am rambling now.
No, it's great. You're kind of getting into a lot of the history in comics in the 20th century. I think it's great. What else do you seek to accomplish with Women Writes About Comics? Like, what further work? What further work do you feel like you have to do?
So, actually, starting in August, we're going to be rebuilding and rebranding the site. We're going to split all of the different sections on the site, like comics, TV, books, etc., into their own blogs under a new parent company. And the banner is going to be called Bleeding Heart Press. Starting last year, we started to put out our own print publication. So we're going to make a push into print, and we're also going to try to build up our blogs, film and television, books, gaming, as well, to do similar projects in those areas. So really, we just want to expand the platform for more writers, and we want to give them paying opportunities in print as well. So we started with a sort of a literary and comic scene, and the next project is going to be a print ongoing comics criticism scene. And we have a few other projects under our belt that we're working on that I don't want to talk about yet, but that's sort of the general scope of where we're going.
I guess this will be my last question, but if you have any advice for independent creators that distribute their content through small press or through online blogs, what advice do you have for them to make their voices heard?
The number one thing that they have to do is build a good and solid network, because you're going to need a ton of support in order to really get your message out. There's so many people working in comics, be it in criticism, in creation, that it's going to be difficult for you to break through even with a really good project. So you're going to need to build a really good network of people that you can really rely on. And in order to do that, you're going to have to boost their projects as well sometimes, but only boost them if you actually believe in them. Don't boost things just for the sake of boosting. Mm-hmm. And then say yes to a lot of projects like anthologies, try to apply for anthologies, do blogging, pitch at larger magazines as well. Like The Guardian takes an incredible amount of comics content lately, actually, and it's a great way to get your name out. And it's a great way to get published, actually, because those are the kinds of sites that publishers are reading, and they'll remember your name. And volunteer at events. I mean, honestly, it's the same kind of career advice that you get anywhere else. It's just build your network, say yes to as many projects as possible, and, I don't know, don't take out a loan to make a comic, because you will go bankrupt.
Mm-hmm. Well, those are all the questions that I have. Did you want to add anything else? So I do want to thank you for sitting and spending the time with me and talking about your work.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course.
And that was Kyle's interview with Megan Purdy of Women Write About Comics. More information about what they're up to, you can check out their website, womenwriteaboutcomics.com. For those of you just joining us, I am just Jess. We are talking today about comics. I'm in the studio with Kyle and Conch, and our special guests here, we have Milan and David to hear talk about their upcoming film documentary. Hello, gentlemen. Welcome to Kibu.
Hi. Hi. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, this is Milan Ersig and David Chelsea. And tell us, Milan, about this. This is your first directorial effort. I know you've been working on a bunch of great documentaries, including Beauty is Embarrassing, the profile of Wayne White, who worked on Pee-wee's Playhouse. But yeah, tell us about 24 Hour Comic. This is local. This is about as grass-ritty as you can get here in Portland.
Well, it's a film which you actually make an appearance in.
Kibu has a cameo.
Yeah, and it also made me realize, like, hey, I'm I'm winging it as a interviewer and a documentarian, because you came in and at a certain point in the film come in and interview people. I'm like, man, there's a professional at work. I was honored to have you there, and it was a great part of the film. But so 24-hour comic is essentially about 8 comic book artists confined to a comic book store, each one trying to make a 24-page comic in 24 hours straight without sleeping. It's a little bit like a self-imposed breakfast club, and there's no jocks and beauty queens. It's just like, I mean, they're beautiful, but it's just all, you know, nerds and geeks, and they'd rather be sketching in their sketchbooks and making comics. And essentially, it's based on Scott McCloud's 24-hour comic challenge, which.
Scott McCloud is the author of Understanding Comics, which is taught in universities now about the comics form, about, you know, the history of it and everything. So, yeah, this was a real, you got a real score talking with Scott.
Oh, absolutely. And I got a real score talking to a lot of people. If David Chelsea wasn't so loved by everybody in the comics industry, I wouldn't have been able to talk to some of these, like, comic luminaries that I got to, including Mike Richardson. So Scott McCloud is based on his thing, and we have him in it, and it's really, honestly, it's more of a character profile of these artists and what makes them tick. I really wanted to put the viewer at the table with these people and hopefully inspire them to want to do the same thing.
Yeah, so David, you are, I think, the champion. How many 24-hour comics have you made? It's coming up on 20, I believe.
Right now, it's just at 17.
And this is, okay, tell us the exact form. Tell us how tell us the rules for a 24-hour comic.
The rules for a 24-hour comic is that you sit down and you try to draw a page an hour. And that can be, you know, one panel. It can be 6 panels. I actually sat next to an artist who did an increasing number of panels as he went on. So the first one was 1, the second was 2, the third was 3. I think he actually fell asleep at 16.
Now, one of the things, the premiere was actually last night, and there's a matinee coming up today, actually, at 4 p.m. at the Laurelhurst. And one of the things that you were mentioning yesterday was that you started out as an illustrator. So you were doing just very noodly art when you started out, book covers and things like that. And getting into comics, you realized you had to up your game a little bit. And so 24-hour comics, it's almost like speed chess in a way. You know, it's using that improv ability, like setting aside all of the perfectionism and letting kind of your subconscious rule.
Yeah, actually, the whole impetus for the 24-hour comic came from Scott McCloud observing his friend Steve Bissette, who was a procrastinator and a slow worker, observing him at a comics convention drawing a sketch in a fan's book and taking 10 minutes to do it and doing a beautiful piece of work absolutely without hesitation. And Scott said, Steve, if you could do that in 10 minutes, you could draw an entire page of comics in an hour, 6 panels. If you could do that 24 times, then you would have an entire comic book. And Steve Bissette said, nobody can sit down and draw an entire comic in 24 hours. And Scott said, well, I will if you will. And Steve said, you first.
One of the fun parts of the movie is that there's all these introverts who normally work by themselves in their studios, you know, up in their lofts or their basements or whatever, and they're toiling away. But now they're all together, and there's a range of ages and styles and genders and everything like that. And they're all thrown together in this room, and they're getting, as the night goes on, 10 a.m. to 10 a.m. the next day, they're getting crispier, they're getting more honest, they're getting more frank. You know, everything's kind of getting full of sugar and caffeine. So this it almost becomes like a reality show, but like much more honest than the reality shows you actually see on TV.
Well, yeah, it is. The situation's a little contrived. Milan kind of picked people that he thought would be interesting personalities to be part of this. But the reactions were all genuine, and, you know, the interaction was, you know, quite spontaneous.
Yeah, Milan, tell us a little bit about the folks involved.
Well, so we have, it all started with David Chelsea, you know, comes in as like the veteran champion type character. It's funny to call them characters because they're just people exactly in a situation. We have Paul Guinan. You may know him as the creator of Boilerplate, along with his partner and wife, Anina Bennett. She makes a very brief appearance in the film, but together they created Boilerplate. So we have them, absolutely wonderful. We have Rachel Neighbors, absolutely fantastic artist and somebody who's actually moved into like, she travels all over the world. She gets flown all over to talk about comics and animation and with web and so forth. We have David's daughter, Rebecca, who's the youngest participant. She was 13 at the time. Now she's like, what, 40? It's been so long. she's past us all. She's older than us all now. But and then we have Pete and Jacob. Pete Soloway, creator of, along with Jacob, Barkles, America's Favorite Dog. And you'll understand that when you see the film. Jacob Mercy, who they kind of worked on this together. Jacob also did his own at the same time. Jacob worked on one about a high school heist. And then we had, she appeared as Sarah Stanton in the film. Since then, she now works under the name Opal Pence. Absolutely a wonderful artist and a beautiful soul that added yet another great quality to the film. We have the brilliant Tom Lechner, who is a phenomenal artist and a genius. I mean, he's casually mentions in the film, he's like, I'm forgetting my own for the Caltech. I was gonna say it's like ITT Tech. No, it's Caltech, and he, he's probably a mathematician. He's extremely smart. He can create his own software. And he makes fantastic drawings, and he goes there and he's just very brutally honest about the stuff he makes, and even his little eraser shavings cup that's made out of a incomplete dodecahedron that just, I don't know how this is not a great description for radio, but you just got to see him. They're all just great.
Were there any specific aspects of the comic making process that you were trying to hone in on?
I think it's just pressing their abilities. It's whatever the means you have to go through to make a comic at that speed. It makes you remove certain blocks. It's about removing those blockages that will hang you up. Decision making and stuff, because you have to work so fast. You creativity comes out in a way that you didn't even know. Scott McCloud had a great quote. It's like sometimes you're working on a frame, but you don't even know what it is yet, and you're already working on it. So it takes you to a level that sometimes may not look as good as some of your finished pieces, but you really are able to do things that are in many ways better than you would have done otherwise. And then, of course, the camaraderie. It's just the environment. You're sitting next to other people doing the same thing, if that answers.
I've seen David do more than one 24-hour comic, and there's one time, David, when you were challenging yourself, you would take a reference piece of art out of a box randomly every hour, and you would have to work that. You would make yourself work that into that particular page.
Yeah, that was...
It was like an improv exercise.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun, and in some cases, I really couldn't, but I used it anyway. Like, I remember there was a character running down the corridors of a building, and there just happened to be a football game going on behind him, because that was the piece of reference that I pulled. But there were other things that actually helped the story. And it's good to not lock yourself in and to have just a fairly loose story, because then you can really work in the moment. I've had some occasions where I actually carry a complete story around in my head, and that turned out to be a mistake, because I would be so anxious to tell the story that I would tell it in a very economical way, and then find myself 10 minutes short of 24 hours, or 10 pages short of 24 pages, and I had run out of story. Had to do something.
Well, the there's a great moment in the film 24-Hour Comic where a couple of the guys are just trying to figure out how to spin the story because they are being so improvised. I want to let people know that a matinee screening of the new documentary 24-Hour Comic is going to be presented this afternoon at 4 o'clock at the Laurelhurst Theater. And it's an all-ages show, so the underage members of the cast will be in attendance, the people who are not yet 21 who were in the movie. We have a few pairs of tickets to give away for that screening. If you are one of the first five lucky callers, those tickets can be yours. The number to call is 503-231-8187. Filmmaker Milan Ersig will be in attendance at this afternoon screening of 24-Hour Comic at the Laurelhurst Theater, and he'll be leading a Q&A session with the local comics artists who are featured in the film. So again, the number to call to win yourself a pair of tickets is 503-231-8187.
And Milan, I was curious, are any of those comics that actually got developed available for people to read and look at it or even purchase?
Most of them have them in some form or other. I think it would be nice to have a more formal put together of these things, perhaps for like a special edition DVD at some point. But Pete Solway, that did Barkles with Jacob Mercy, I know has some copies and he can up the production of those. Plus a new Barkles edition that's absolutely fantastic, and they're selling those. Paul Guinan has his boilerplate. I know I have a copy, and I've seen copies of those from that session. David, I'm so familiar with your stuff. I'm trying to think. Do you have actually that one? I know you have a number of your anthologies that are put out by Dark Horse.
Yeah, I have two anthologies put out by Dark Horse, but actually those only cover the first 12 I did, and this one I believe is number 16. That actual story that I drew in your film is called All Day and All of the Night, and it's available in three parts on my Patreon page. So if anybody wants to check out my Patreon page, you can search All Day and All of the Night, and you can find the actual comic. I'll just put in a plug for my Patreon page. That comic and the previous one, which is called Are You Being Watched, I combined into a news story, which I spent more time on. I used my not 24-hour comic style, and I've done it as a continuing web comic, serializing it every week for the past 2 years. And just yesterday, the same day as that premiere, I put up the final installment.
Wow, that's wonderful. Milan, do you have any web presence that people can look at for your other films that you've worked on?
Well, I have... There's definitely a presence on Beauty is Embarrassing. Neil Berkley, the director of that, and I, we were nominated for Emmys for that because there was a lot of great animation and design and animation that, and it was for design and animation we were nominated for. That's definitely out there and available. Neil Berkley's gone on to make even more wonderful documentaries, and he's quite prominent. As far as documentaries, that's the only other feature documentary that I'm involved with. I was a producer on that, and then, of course, like a art director involved there. And then I have a credit as an executive producer on a romantic comedy called Temps, which my executive producer on this film, I helped him out on that one. But that wasn't a documentary. So as far as web presence, these all can be found mostly on iTunes. Speaking of iTunes, we are currently in the pre-order stage for 24-Hour Comic, and it's on sale. Today is the last day it's on sale for only $6.99, so it's going to be more than that, but it really, the iTunes pre-sales is the best way a small indie doc like this can gain great prominence. We've got great momentum. We've been doing phenomenal on the charts for the pre-orders, and, every single one or two or few pre-orders helps us it makes the trailer in that film available for people to see, and they see how great it is, and it gains traction. So that is where you can look 24-hour comic up on iTunes. Check out the trailer there. If you like it, you can support us by pre-ordering. If you hate it, then don't. But
and I know there's also a 24hourcomicmovie.com 24 hour, that you can see.
Yes,
as well.
You can do that as well, and it will link you to some of those things.
Perfect.
Too. So there's a more direct way, and you can see a lot more about it. So,
wonderful.
Thank you.
Now, are you two going to be at the Radio Geekly is going to be at the Portland Zine Symposium later this month, and I'm wondering if, because I know the both of you have been involved in small press ventures, and so I'm wondering if that's a thing that that you'll be part of. I know, David, you've put out a whole bunch of, you've put out a bunch of small press comics that have turned into big releases from Dark Horse and other publishers.
Well, from time to time. Usually it's my 24-hour comics. I'll copy some out and sell them at comics conventions. Actually, I did my first mini comic in 1989, I think it was. I did an early version of my graphic novel, Welcome to the Zone, as just this tiny little booklet.
And now it's a big graphic novel.
And now it's a big graphic novel, which is out of print, but because there's a character in it based on Donald Trump, there's new interest. So I've been selling more of them at conventions when I show up.
Nice. Well, we're going to take a quick music break and talk more about the Zine Symposium in just a few minutes. But thank you, Milan and David, for coming by. And we'll continue more with our discussion on comics in just a few minutes.
Superheroes, I would read them by myself.
And that was Sheena is a punk rocker from the Ramones. And fun fact, they actually named that song after Sheena, Queen of the Jungle. Mm. I'm sure several of you are familiar with that comic. She was actually the first comic character to be released, to be published in comic book form before Wonder Woman.
Oh.
In 1937.
Mm.
Yeah. So, fun fact.
That is an interesting fun fact.
Robert Crumb was apparently really taken with Sheena, if I recall.
That's right. Oh, yeah. He used to watch the show.
Like erotically obsessed with
Yeah. I remember that.
If you're just joining us, this is Radio Geekly. I'm just Jess in the studio with Conch and Kyle and Milan and David talking about 24-Hour Comic. And I had a question about the comics scene. If for those listeners that are interested in starting their own comic or wanting to go down the road of becoming a comic artist, how does that happen in terms of where to start? Is it good to go to school about it? Is it good to just self-publish? What would you say would be kind of the first steps to take in order to achieve a comic placement in the world?
It kind of depends on what your ambition is and what sort of cartoonist you want to be. I mean, a lot of people want to be Marvel or DC artists. And, you know, that can be a very arduous career path. And the best thing I ever heard about that, or the best piece of advice I ever heard about that, was just start anywhere and work from there.
Hmm.
But if you just want to draw comics and draw them yourself and have them seen, there are almost no barriers to entry. I mean, you know, there was always the zine scene, and I guess the barrier to entry was, you know, could you figure out how to fold a booklet and staple it? Now, of course, if you're at all computer savvy, you can get online and you can do what I do, which is do Patreon, or you can do Kickstarter, or if you're not even trying to get revenue, you know, have a website, set up a website, and put your comics online, and someone will see them, you know, possibly just your family or people you go to school with.
Hmm.
And speaking of stapling booklets, will you guys be at the Zine Symposium this year?
Oh, I so want to go to it. I've gotten so into zines just through some of the social media reach out, and just realized how many fantastic ones there are out there. And I've been following so many zinesters and made friends with so many. And I want to go. My heart's broken for that. But we actually we're going to be in San Diego at Comic-Con. The 24-Hour Comic is an official selection of the San Diego Comic-Con. So David and I will be down there, and a few others with the film, and we're going to screen it there and meet people doing stuff. So I will be too far away to be able to go to...
That makes the choice, you know, as stark as it possibly could be. San Diego or Zine Symposium?
I'm telling you, I love zines. I mean, it is hard. I actually really want to. It's been brought more to my forefront lately. I keep getting blown away by the ones I'm seeing out there.
And for those who aren't going down to San Diego, today, 4 p.m., Laurelhurst, matinee of 24-Hour Comic with the filmmaker and several of the stars.
And we still do have pairs of tickets available if you call 503 231-8187. You can get some of those tickets to see the show today at 4 p.m. So, and the fun, cool thing about the Zine Symposium, since we are not going to go to San Diego, is that the ARG Collective actually has a panel on Saturday morning at the Zine Symposium, and we're going to be discussing comics as resistance, right?
That's right. It's going to be Saturday morning, first day of the festival. And it should be good. I'm super excited for it.
Yeah, it's going to be meeting at Apano Jams. They're on Southeast Division Street. Information about that can be found at the PortlandZineSymposium.org. And more information about the 24-hour comic, if you want to see the iTunes preview
pre-order.
Trailer. Oh, pre-order, correct. Thank you. Is at 24hourcomic.com. 24hourcomicmovie.com. Yes. Or they can just go to iTunes and search for 24-hour comic. Is that correct?
Correct.
Cool. And David, what was your Patreon website again? Is it just searching for David Chelsea?
Yeah, I mean, it's some extremely incomprehensible series of letters and numbers. Best to go to Patreon and just search for David Chelsea.
Okay.
And, if you are starting out as a comics artist, you can do worse than check out David's Perspective! ! For Artists.
Oh, yes.
Instructional book.
And that's something I want to mention. If you are interested in getting better at comics, a good place to start is Scott McCloud's book, Understanding Comics. He did a follow-up called Making Comics, which is more just, teaching you how to do it. My book is kind of inspired by Scott. I've done three books about perspective. They're instructional books. The first one is called Perspective with an ! The second is Extreme Perspective! ! And the third is Perspective in Action! ! And, for artists who are interested in getting the perspective and especially, the backgrounds right, that book is highly praised, including by Scott McCloud.
And Kyle, you mentioned there are some classes that sometimes go on around town at places like Books with Pictures.
Yeah, I was thinking of Books with Pictures. They do have sometimes they bring lectures of people from the industry or instructional groups for kids and stuff. And yeah.
That's so great. I'm looking forward to being a part of that panel and also learning more about comics. I'm glad that all these wonderful guests have been in the studio, because I have definitely been educated, and looking forward to next month when we come back and tell you all of the fun things that we learned at the Zine Symposium. I know for myself, it'll be more educational than for some of you guys. You probably were more excited just geeking out on all the new comics that are coming out and things. So that'll be wonderful. So thank you to David and Milan for joining us in the studio today. Best of luck with the movie. Best of luck with all the rest of your endeavors and summertime plans and things of that nature. We're going to move on to talking about some upcoming events that are going to be happening in and around the Rose City for you for the month of July. If you are looking to get outside and do some fun things, there is the Robin Hood Festival down in Old Town Sherwood on July 14th through the 16th. Yes, it is kind of like a Renaissance fair. Yes, they encourage you to cosplay. Yes, they like you to join and bring the family and have fun. More information about that is robinhoodfestival.org. Or if Robin Hood's not your thing and maybe you're more of a pirate seafarer, there's also the Sea Dog Nights and Gypsy Carnival down in Lebanon, Oregon, where you actually dress up and camp for three nights dressed like a pirate, which is pretty amazing.
Seems like a good place to LARP, I would think.
Yes, definitely a good place.
Rum not included.
No, unfortunately, you might need to bring your own.
You'd be a pirate stranded inland, I guess.
Yes, an inland pirate. Information about that festival is at seadognights.com, which is SEADOGNIGHTS.com. Or if you want to stay local here in the Portland area, the summertime is always good for those movies and concerts in the park. There's all throughout the month of July, August, and even parts of September. You can find out information about when those are going to be playing at portlandoregon.gov/parks. Portland Scene Symposium, July 23rd and 22nd at Apano Jams, where the Radio Geekly Collective is going to be a part of. PortlandZineSymposium.org. The 2017 Star Trek Convention is going to be happening in Las Vegas. But one of our collective members, Godiva, actually has her tickets, and she's going to try to get us interviews with some of the cast from Star Trek The Next Generation. That is being held on August 2nd through the 6th at the Rio Hotel. Then there might be tickets still available. I don't know for sure. But if not, you will get first-hand coverage from the ARG Collective in September when she comes back to report on all things Star Trek. It's going to be pretty exciting because I was a TNG kid when I was growing up. Geordi was my favorite. So, and last but not least, if you're looking for some theater time, not a movie, but actual live production theater, the Visit to a Small Planet sci-fi comedy by Gore Vidal is going to be playing at the Lakewood Center for the Arts in Lake Oswego from July 8th through August 13th. Information about that could be found at lakewood-center.org. So I want to thank everybody for joining us today on a Radio Geekly. And any final thoughts from you guys before we sign off?
Well, there is one other event that's coming up that's pretty cool, especially for the local cartooning community, especially for folks who are politically themed. If you are a cartoonist who's got a political cartoon lying around, there is a cool festival down in Silverton called the Homer Davenport Community Festival, August 4th through the 6th. And Homer Davenport was a famous groundbreaking editorial cartoonist back in Great Grandpa's day, the turn of the last century. They are doing a contest, invitational type thing. I'm normally allergic to art contests because most of them are geared towards soliciting new works with all kinds of specifications. I'm a dyed-in-the-wool, pay-the-artist purist. But this one, Gus Frederick, who's doing this, he wants just politically-themed cartoons you may have lying around, would like to send in. There's cash prizes up to $750, and there's a gallery show you can get your work into down in Silverton. It's big fun, the gallery show down there, and the whole Homer Davenport Festival is a lot of fun, too. And there's no restrictions on content other than it's not, no racist or sexist things. But, yeah, so entries will be prominently displayed in Silverton, August 4th through the 6th. And information is homerdavenport.com/ToonCon. That's ToonCon.
Awesome. There's lots to do here this summertime in the Rose City. So looking forward to having you guys have fun adventures, read some comics. We'll catch you on the flip side in next month's edition of A Radio Geekly. Stay tuned at noon for Moving On. And you're tuned in to your community radio station here at KBOO Portland. Thanks, guys.